Worried about letting someone else pick out the perfect avocado for your perfect impress them on the third date guacamole? Well, good thing Instacart shoppers are as picky as you are. They find ripe avocados like it's their guac on the line. They are milk expiration date detectives. They bag eggs like the 12 precious pieces of cargo they are. So let Instacart shoppers overthink your groceries so that you can overthink what you'll wear on that third date. Download the Instacart app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
Well, Diane, it is the most wonderful time of the year. I always say Thanksgiving time is for football, for food, and for fat guys. And so guys like me, this is just the perfect time of the year because we're going to sit down, we're going to have some beverages, we're going to watch football, we're going to eat a lot of good food. And, you know, I know we've talked in the past about the history of the Kansas-Missouri game and how that was kind of centered around Thanksgiving. But the game of football really does have a big kind of hold on us here in the Midwest. I mean, just look what's going on over the last couple of years with the Chiefs. Football's a big thing here in Kansas City, isn't it? And it started way back before, like, you know, Kansas City was even born.
Oh, that's a little bit of an exaggeration. But same year as the Hannibal Bridge. So, you know, we're connecting with the East Coast the same year the East Coast kind of brought us football. So actually your neck of the woods is more, you know, football Hall of Fame, if you will, with the beginnings of football. But yeah, Kansas and Missouri and, you know, kind of researching this, I was a little nervous. That's why I sent you the draft when I was writing it, because I was a little nervous about facts, because it's really hard. If you go out and you start looking around about the history of football, it is muddy. It's really muddy. And I am a fact girl. And so it's really hard to kind of imagine just what are the basic, you know, original rules and how did this even happen and who ever thought it was a good idea to do this without protection, like padding and helmets, which is just to me fascinating. So I wanted to make sure when I wrote this that I did it from a way that would have taught everybody something, whether you know anything about football or not. And then especially with all the new fans we have here in Kansas City, apparently. But then also to tell it from kind of a fun, relatable way about like things that we don't even think about, like helmets, like padding and things like that. So it's a nasty history. One of my favorite quotes I saw out there just about reimagining what football was like. And they were like, it was the Wild West out there. What rules? There were none.
and that's the interesting thing about football. I know, and we'll get into it, you know, everybody assumes that James Naismith invented basketball and people are spending millions of dollars on these alleged rules of the game. We know about baseball getting started, you know, and how all that kind of got started, and the original rules of baseball and all of that. And, you know, the founder of the game is Abner Doubleday. And then, you know, the founder of the game of basketball, allegedly James Naismith. Nobody really knows who, quote unquote, the founder of football is.
Right.
And you're right. It did start where I grew up in New Jersey. Princeton and Rutgers had the first football game that ended like 12-4. I mean, and people are mad at the Chiefs for not scoring enough points right now. I mean, could you imagine if some of these Chiefs fans went to that original game between Princeton and Rutgers and saw a 12-4 final? They wouldn't know what to do with themselves. But it really is I don't want to say convoluted history of the game of football,
it's
but for
the
other
clear.
Sports, it's not. The other sports, you kind of know who those main players are. And for football, people are like, I don't know, but it's fun to watch.
Right. And in those early, like you said, I can only imagine because, you know, we like what, you know, I can remember the Marty Schottenheimer days to kind of take people back to when I really became a true fan of football. When I knew the rules, I should say, it was the Schottenheimer era. And it was like best defense, no offense. And, you know, it's like we want the offense to throw the football. That's exciting. And so I think about early football and wonder with those scores, kind of, you know, the rules, you know, that really put preferential treatment on field goals and not on touchdowns in general. And that's why, you know, looking at the history of football in the early, you know, it's a combination of rugby and soccer, which I mean, you know, that's why football name doesn't make much sense, but whatever. And so really different from rugby because there was an alternating time of possession, and then obviously different from soccer because you can legally hold the ball. But to see like gridiron football, 1869, so post-Civil War, and these, you know, Ivy League schools coming up with this game, no clear real understanding of where this came from, but the name gridiron comes from the vertical lines on the field, but it was also known as mob football because of how crazy it was. And I mean, I wish there was footage, you know, because we cannot imagine what we picture of football today after reading about this. It looks very little. Like, number of men on the field depends on who you're playing. Mm-hmm. Like, it didn't, like, they didn't have any clear rules. And so Princeton, like you said, versus Rutgers happened November 6, 1869 in your home state of New Jersey. And then they adapted rules from the London Football Association. So we're dealing with rules that aren't even football. Like, they're just like, we'll just choose these rules for today. And then in 1873, they created the Intercollegiate Football of America, so IFA, and that was founded again by your Ivy League schools, so Princeton, Harvard, Yale, Columbia. And they founded that, and then they still didn't sit down and write any rules. They waited three more years. They're like, probably to figure out, because there was no clear, like, founder. I'm guessing it was to kind of figure out what worked, you know? Like, mm-hmm. I guess your play, you wouldn't have had a lot of people to play. Your season wasn't a complete, you know, say 14 game season. Like, that wouldn't have been the case. It was who's available to play. Okay, we'll see a Saturday. And that's how it happened. I mean, so it's the one clear person, I guess, that they say is the, you know, founder, the father of American football, is Walter Camp. Mm-hmm. And he played, you know, born in 1859. And I love this because, you know, he played for Yale from 1877 and 1882. And what people don't realize too is that there were no college coaches back then. So when we think about, and this is for all sports, like my great grandfather was the coach at Rutgers University, and he was from the first graduating class of Rutgers High School and Rutgers College. And the reason they had college football, basketball, and baseball was because my great grandfather was coaching and playing at the same time. They didn't actually have players that, or I should say hired coaches. And the agreement to actually have a football team in the first place had to do with the faculty agreeing that this would be an okay thing to do. So whoever was the best player was your captain and your coach. So like, calling the plays as they see him on the field, that's what Walter Camp was doing. And he was just a super great athlete. And so he was actually offered to serve on the rules committee. And he did from 1877 to 1925. And this guy, once he was done with his football career and he went off to work for his family's clock company in, like, you know, Connecticut, he's still working on, you know, for the IFA, hosting and figuring out the rules of the game when he wasn't even playing. But he was the guy. So in 1883, they established some new rules. And I'm like, what were the old rules? Good luck finding them. I have no idea. I have no idea. But this is when we have things that sound familiar. So the team would give up the ball after failing to move down the field after a certain number of downs, obviously four. Mm-hmm. And then this is when we finally say, not 13, not six men, not eight, but 11. Like, that's how many you can have on the field. And then they started with offensive signal calling at this point, and the creation of the quarterback position happened the same year, and the line of scrimmage became a thing. And so also in 1883, they established the football scoring rules. A touchdown was 4 points. Extra point was two. A safety was still two. That's like the only thing that stayed the same. Field goal, 5 points, and then two halves, 45 minutes each. I don't know about timeouts. Like, again, nothing's clear, but those, some things sound familiar, but as you can hear, like, the touchdown is still not worth as much as the field goal,
right?
Which is really interesting. You know,
well, I mean, when you really think about it, I mean, it's not easy to kick the ball through the uprights.
That's true.
I mean, so maybe they thought back in the day, like, we should award more points because this is a harder thing to do than it is to, you know, get into the end zone. And as we know today, neither is easy in football.
Right.
But I think what really, to me, like, as you're kind of talking about the rules of football, and I was reading your article the other day, you know, about it, and you bring up Walter Camp. I think if you ask the average football fan who Walter Camp is, they don't have
They don't know.
They don't
have
know
no
who
idea.
Walter Camp is, right? And that's a microcosm of the game of football, which is also, I think, why the game of football is so widely popular and successful now compared to baseball and maybe even basketball, is because none of us that are football fans really know or care about what happened in the past. You know, baseball's holding on to all these records from the 1800s. Oh my God, we can't change anything. What about the records? The records. And you know, I love history with the rest of them. I love hearing about it, but I also like the fact that we really don't know much about the history of football. And I don't think that's necessarily a bad thing, because it's allowed the sport to grow and evolve, where people are going, hold on a second here, Babe Ruth did this with 158 games.
You have a point. You know. Yeah. Well, and that's true. I mean, like, again, referencing back to my own personal sports history with my great grandfather, Pat Mason, he had never played football. And then it was like, Rockhurst wants to create a football team. And he's like, okay. And he ends up quarterback. It's like, you know, I mean, because I think that what we have to realize too is an athlete is an athlete. Right.
You literally just stole the words out of my mouth, Diane, because I was getting ready to say about your great grandfather, who I've never met. An athlete is an athlete. And we were having the conversation on the radio show the other day. There was a football player by the name of CJ Stroud. He's a rookie this year, mm-hmm. right? In the NFL, plays quarterback. And he said, all football players want to play basketball. All basketball players want to play football. And everybody wants to be a baseball player. Mm-hmm. And we were having the conversation, like, if you're a high level athlete, I'm not telling you, you can't, because I believe that you can. Because athletes are just different than the normal, you know, you and I sitting here. They're going to go out there and they're going to, all right, you're going to tell me I can't. Oh, I'm going to show you that I can.
Yeah. And I think that's what really formulated, because when you do look at some of the early people that were playing, they were looking for the guy who you know, might have been late to class and running really fast down campus. Like, that guy's got some speed. Like, you're looking for natural talent, especially when a sport has absolutely, like, a quarterback, you can imagine. Yeah, of course, you have to be able to throw the ball. But what are they looking at for, you know, athletic purposes when they barely know the rules of football? Mm-hmm. Like, they don't even know what they're doing. That's the formation of these teams, especially in the Midwest, because it's not like they could pull footage. Like, let's see what Harvard's doing. I mean, there was no such thing as that.
Right.
So they're going off of what they're reading. And, you know, maybe a friend went up to the, you know, the Northeast and saw a game being played at a park. This looks fun. Let's do this. Mm-hmm. And then they're figuring it out as they go, which I love people that are willing to take risks and just try it out, see what happens. And I mean, it is a little dangerous to be trying to figure stuff out, you know, when you really have no idea what you're doing. But I mean, the history of both Mizzou and KU kind of go back to that idea of, well, this looks like fun. Let's try. Let's just see what happens. And the way those teams were formed, because in the 1880s, and I told you this, you know, through actually just texting, but the 1880s was the, like, I feel like it's the era of stealing things, because how patents, you know, sure, patents were happening, but in general, people's ideas, it's like everybody had that idea. And then whoever gets credited with it gets credited with it. The same idea here with, you know, Mizzou and KU's, you know, football history and how it starts. It's like I kind of got conflicting views. I thought first KU had a team before Mizzou, and I think they were playing like just maybe around, you know, the campus or something. But in 1890 is kind of the year that we can say for sure that there were football teams. But the way they're created is almost by class. So it's like the class of 93 has a football team and the class of 92 had a football team. But then also engineering department had a football team. I'm like, wow, who are they choosing for this stuff? It's like, is there a PE department? Choose them.
Yeah.
Choose those guys.
You don't want the engineers.
Don't choose the engineers. Please don't choose the engineers.
You want them as your coaches, though, figuring out ways to get it done and figuring out ways to win. So, yeah, engineers would be great, you know, from that standpoint. But, you know, the KU-MU football thing is unbelievable, because both sides disagree even how many times it's been played and who leads the whole thing, which I think – just really adds to that rivalry. In a couple of years, it'll be back, and we'll get the opportunity to see that again on the gridiron. It's going to be fun, but nobody really knows who leads, who doesn't lead, when it started, you know, all that kind of stuff. And shockingly, Kansas and Missouri can't find the common ground on anything.
That's no surprise. Yeah, but
you got betting, you got weed. I mean, it's just, you know.
Seriously. I know. Just come down the middle. Just come in the middle. When they're organizing their football teams and trying to figure this out, I actually was pretty surprised that Mizzou, when they were trying to organize their football association, football being accented with two words, of course, football association, they were trying to find somebody to play. Again, here we go. Like, great. We have a team. Who are we going to play? And they found Washington University in St. Louis, which I had no idea this was true, but they had a football team since 1887, which would have been early for this year, you know, this neck of the woods. And so they were like, let's play them. It'll be fun. And so Mizzou goes marching into St. Louis on, you know, Thanksgiving Day. That was a big football day even then. And it was an absolute disaster. They got killed in front of 3,000 people. Because they had no idea what they were doing. They lost 28-0. And I found a great quote from a guy, Burton Thompson. He was a fullback for Mizzou. And he said, like, we were taught that our only defense must be with the shoulders and arms or by interference with the body. We had been strictly warned not to use our hands, open or close, in warding off a man. But alas, the umpire and referee observed no such rules of the game. Yeah. So they like come in, they're like not using their arms.
Well, I mean, if you look at some of the early footage of football, guys would actually go in. I mean, you don't see tackling anymore in the NFL, right? Guys just want to throw their shoulder and do that kind of stuff. But some of the early days, I'm sure, like when we were taught to, you know, have a blocking sled and block the sled, you were just taught to put your hand in it and kind of hold your shirt with your hands clenched, like make like wings and move forward. That's kind of how we were taught back in, you know, when I was playing high school football in the 90s and the 80s and whatnot. So I can only imagine what it was like back then. I mean, you go back and watch some of this old footage, guys aren't wearing helmets. They're hardly wearing pads.
Oh, no.
You know, it became a mess, right?
Well, an absolute mess. And yeah, the rivalry happens and stuff like that. But when you look at, again, who created what? Who knows?
Right.
And I actually found three different, I only mentioned two in my article, but three different people who supposedly created the football helmet. Because I thought out of all the things to know you need to protect, maybe it's your brain.
Maybe.
I don't know.
Yeah. Maybe. But I still think they should play football without helmets right now. And
what?
Hear me out. Oh, absolutely. Because guys lead with their helmet. We're trying to eliminate concussions.
Oh, that's
We're trying
true.
To lead with our helmets. If you don't have a helmet on, you ain't leading with your melon, you know?
That's true. That would stop some things.
Yeah.
Like, well, some guys might not be smart enough to not do that. But yeah, so Mizzou, or I should say the football association, where we kind of think of like the early Big 12, I mean, what was the Big 12, Big 8, whatever, was the Western Interstate Football Association with Nebraska, Iowa, Kansas, and Missouri. And so that kind of created more play. But as this is happening, this is when I'm like, where's the protection? So I looked into the football helmet, and there's three different stories. The first one, which is probably the most common you see, which is interesting because there's picture evidence of other things, is that at the Army-Navy game in 1893, a guy named Joseph Mason Bull Reeves was hit in the head so many times that he was warned by his doctor that he cannot be hit anymore because he might end up instantly insane.
Yeah, that happened back then. People, people became instantly insane. Yeah.
So he's like, maybe I'll heed the warning. So he goes to some shoemaker and has him make a moleskin cap with him for him with the ear flaps. I'm going to be clear. Like, this would have been like putting on a snow, like your lightest snow leather contraption to go, you know, shovel your driveway in 32 degree weather. Mm-hmm. Like, this thing ain't protecting you. But still, that's what they say. They're like, well, first game that we ever see it is this. But then, as we kind of brought up earlier, talk about Naismith. I said 1891 was a good year for him, but then you would argue with me that he did not create basketball in that year. But he's teaching PE at YMCA's International Training School in Massachusetts. And he started that in 1890. He's not obviously at KU yet. And he's with Pioneer Sportsman A.A. Stagg, right?
Alonzo Stagg, yeah. Sure.
Yeah, yeah. So he's with him. And he had played for Yale. And Naismith was center for McGill University. And so they were like,
you know who else played at McGill University?
Who?
Laurent Duvernay-Tardif, Super Bowl champion with the Chiefs. He's, and you know whose mother went to McGill University?
Who?
Andy Reid's.
Oh, how cool.
Yeah, wow. See, I'm teaching McGill's you a little famous. Something right now. I don't know who else went to McGill besides those two. And then obviously Naismith is a serial thief. This guy steals basketball from Lambert Will and then goes out there and steals the helmet from Alonzo Stagg and takes credit for all this stuff. More power. I mean, back in the day, you just claimed something, you got it, right? Man.
Yeah, and I am surprised, Mr. KU yourself, that you would throw up Naismith and say he was not the creator of basketball.
Well, I mean, we have the information that is out there. I mean, we might as well look into it. I mean, nobody at KU obviously wants to acknowledge it. And I'm sure most people, we've all just been told this, right? We've all been told generations that we've been told that Naismith invented this. But if you start doing some research, there was a guy named Lambert Will, I also believe out of Canada, who allegedly invented this game of basketball. Naismith liked it, stole the idea, started claiming it. And, you know, because he claimed it, he was able to say, I invented it. And more power to him. You know, he's a master salesman, I guess.
Well, and I think that it's important, too, to realize, because I can't argue with you on this, because I did look a little bit into it after you were like, Naismith didn't create basketball. And I was like, how can you be the one to tell me this? This cannot be right. Yeah, I'm like, you're KU and I'm not. How are you telling me that something that KU prides themselves on is incorrect? So I did look a little bit around, and then I was like, ooh, this could use a little, like, this could be somebody's dissertation, honestly.
It really could. I'd love somebody to do a dissertation on this and prove once and for all
who created basketball.
Yeah.
Well, and I think you have to keep in mind that you never know something is innovative or an invention until it becomes famous.
Right.
So when you're creating something, it's not famous. There's no reason to document what you're doing.
And I'll give you an example of that, because back in 1999, we graduated college. All of us went our separate ways. And my friend Paul and I used to play this stupid game with each other because we were bored, and he was living in Toledo and I was living in Seguin, Texas. And we used to call each other and start chewing and say, guess what I'm eating, right? And it was not a turkey sandwich, like whatever, it just to pass the time. There's now a show on Food Network called Guess What I'm Eating. It literally came out like in the last couple of weeks.
Like,
and
I did
that
first
screenshot to my friend Paul. I go, what the hell? He goes, they're stealing our show. You know?
See?
So we've had this idea since 1999. It's so stupid. So Lambert Will probably had the idea, and then James Naismith took it and ran with it.
And made something out of it. And I think that's something you have to give credit where credit's due. And again, I cannot argue. I read that he created it, you know, in 15 days when he was at the YMCA. This is what I read, is all I'm saying. Mm-hmm. But what's interesting, it is not innovative until it's famous, and it's not, and no one cares about the history of something until it's been around for a while.
Right.
So we are looking subjectively at information that doesn't exist, because no one's like, you know, reporting in the newspaper like James Naismith created a new sport today. Like, that's not what's happening. Nobody cares because it's nothing to report.
Right.
So it's really hard to know what really is and isn't.
And then as it becomes popular, people go, where the hell did this come from? I don't know, that Naismith guy up in Massachusetts.
Yeah, he's been doing it for a while.
Right,
exactly. Well, and that's why it was really interesting to read about him. And the fact that this has evidence is interesting, that it actually does predate the Army-Navy game, is that Naismith, same year that air quote basketball was invented, it was at, of course, teaching PE, and he's with Amos Stagg. They've created this football team, and Naismith had cauliflower ears, like super big ears, and he played center, which is pretty aggressive. Mm-hmm. I mean, so anyway, people would grab his ears and pull him to the ground with his ears.
Smart.
I'm like, that would hurt for sure. And so according to the LA Times, his solution was to, with the help of his girlfriend who became his wife, Maud, was to give a helmet with flannel earmuffs over his ears so they couldn't, and have a chin strap so they couldn't grab his ears. And later he would create this contraption that was actually made of leather. And here's the interesting thing, is there's an actual picture of him, which I found, of him wearing a helmet, which would predate the story about the Army-Navy game. So, you know, but he never walked around in KU's campus in 1930 saying, just so you guys know, I also created the helmet. Right. He wasn't saying that. So, but what's really interesting about this is he, like his grandson even said, and his son later when he was interviewed in newspapers after his death, that he was actually prouder of the fact of his helmet creation than he was of his creation or discovery, is what the way they put it, which I hate when people use that word, discovery mm-hmm. versus creation. You can't discover something if it doesn't exist. But anyway, that he created the basketball was not his favorite thing. It was actually the helmet. And of course, in my head, I'm like, of course, because he never played basketball. He was worried he would have his ears ripped off. So that would have been more meaningful to him.
Yeah.
And the other story that is out there too is Spalding. And I think that's more commercial helmets. So that's why I don't really give that one as much credit, because we're talking about more of like the creation of something that you would go buy at the store. Mm-hmm. But first hard helmets were 1920s. And what really blew me away is that helmets were not required in football until 1943.
Well, I mean, there was a guy in the National Hockey League who was grandfathered in by the name of Craig McTavish. He was one of the last guys to not have to wear a helmet in the NHL. And we're talking the 90s. I mean, like, so
that's, you know, crazy.
Yeah, he was grandfathered in because he started playing hockey a certain year.
Under different rules.
Yeah. And they set the rules, like Guy Lafleur may have been one of the last guys as well. Oof. In the NHL that didn't wear a helmet, one of those two guys. And you start to see, okay, if you were in the league by such and such a date, then you didn't have to wear a helmet. But if you came in after that, then everybody had to wear a helmet. So, I mean, you think about like 1920 in football or whatever until they were required. Hockey didn't require them until like the 80s, you know?
It's really confusing to me. And you see the pictures of the early photos of football, like KU and MU, the earliest photo for MU's got one from the first year. KU's earliest is in 1893 is their photo. And of mm-hmm. course, Missouri's got MSU across their shirt, which makes no sense now. And KU's just got a big old K. And by the way, the Tiger, like the mascot, the Tiger, did not come about until football was created, or mm-hmm. they got a football team. It was the football team that actually used the Tiger as their mascot. And you don't really see the whole Mizzou, you know, the Jayhawks, or they were still calling them the Jayhawkers, and that's what their team was called, the Jayhawkers, right. Back in the early days. But you don't really hear about mascots and stuff until really a lot later, you know, like a actual emblem, a symbol, like the 19 teens. Mm-hmm. So really, it was more the colors that mattered and stuff like that. It's fascinating to me because it's really, you know, each region has a different history on what made it, like, because there were states, there were schools that outlawed football mm-hmm. because it was so dangerous and people
were dying.
Yeah. That it was like, and I mean, if we had the numbers of deaths that what we're looking at here, which we'll get to here in a second, we wouldn't have football right now. And this is the thing, because we're a very cautious society. I mean, mm-hmm. I'm still waiting for them to figure out why. Somebody tell me why we don't have seatbelts on buses. Like, this blows school buses. I guess there's not enough. I mean, there needs to be unfortunately a bunch of deaths before somebody says, maybe we should put these in these buses where children are, but whatever. Again, what the emergency wasn't even the talk of safety as in like wearing the helmets. It was like, we've got to redo the rules of football because this ain't working. And so I mean, there was a death at KU. That was an interesting story from 1896, November 14th, a guy named Bert Cerf. He was 18 years old. He's playing for, I think it's Down College out of Nebraska. And he's hit. The guy was hit like the weeks before and like passed out on the field. And they were like, wake up, buddy. And then he would just be at, you know, in class, you know, a week later and like wouldn't know where he was. They're like, come on, buddy. We got football practice. Let's go. So anyway, he's playing against KU and it's like the last minute of the game and he gets hit. He was trying to block the end zone. He gets hit and he goes back right on his head. He's on the ground for 5 minutes. He had already been hit earlier in the game. And like KU was like, dude, pull him out. Like he should not be playing. And they're like, we have to keep him in. We don't have anybody else. So they kept him in. Anyway, he ended up getting hit so hard that he never woke up. They took him back to the Eldridge Hotel where he died at like 11 o'clock that night. And so there was this big uproar in Nebraska. The legislature was going to ban football. Just like, we're not doing football anymore. Sorry, college campuses, get over it. KU's faculty was like, see, this is too dangerous. And KU's like, well, look, we have a letter that says that it wasn't our fault, that they wrote, like, it's not our fault, right? And they were trying to defend it that way. And this went on for years. It just depended on where the injuries were. And as you know, when you have the model at the time was collegiate football. There is no, you know, there's nothing else really happening at this point with, you know, national teams, AFL, NFL, or anything like that. So collegiate football is the cream of the crop. And so, of course, it trickled down to high schools and it trickled down to play at the, you know, the parks and stuff like that. And the statistics of deaths was just absolutely absurd. So in 1905, the New York Herald reported that there had been 45 deaths related to football in 5 years, which those are just what they could find. And remember, just like you were saying, statistics early with football, like, we don't know what the score was. We don't know exactly what happened because no one was sitting down like, maybe we should write this down for the future. They didn't do that. So our early football records are really shady too. So anyway, we don't know for sure about the death number because there was no, you know, collection of that kind of information. But what really did it in is some people say that Teddy Roosevelt saved football. I don't know if I go that far, but Teddy Roosevelt was president and his son, Teddy Jr., was playing on heart. What's that?
Franklin D. was his son.
This is to the son that died actually during the war. Okay.
Well, his son Franklin D. became president after him. Look it up.
No, not his son, his relative. His relative. So he's reporting like, or his son goes off and plays for Harvard. And he's playing like on the freshman team or whatever, ends up getting hurt pretty bad. And of course, he's like, Dad, I'm fine. Don't worry about it. He's like, but I need to go to see a plastic surgeon because my nose is so messed up. And of course, Dad's like, President of the United States, this ain't good. So he says, like, after his son had been laid out twice, like, we got to look at the reforms for football. And at the same time, he's also like, football's a man's sport. So it's not like he wanted it gone. So he actually, in 1905, he invited the coaches from Princeton, Yale, and Harvard, along with some heads of like the alumni committee, to go to the White House to talk about how can we get rid of this horrible violence within football that's causing people to die. And they agreed to make a public statement saying, we denounce viciousness in football. Like, well, so now that did a lot. But in 1905 alone, there were 19 deaths in football. 137 people were injured. 11 high school kids died this year, just 19 deaths, under 17, 11 dead, and 3 college players had died. So this is pretty serious. Like, we got to do something about this. And so with the encouragement of the president at the time, they created, like, we got to do some type of association to look at this closer. And this led to the creation of what would be later called the NCAA, the National Collegiate Athletic Association. But it was first known as the IAAUS, which is the Intercollegiate Athletic Association of the United States. They formed in 1906, and their whole job was to reform the rules of college sports. So deaths in football led to the creation of the NCAA, which led to better record keeping for one, and then also more safety in the game, which thank God that happened because I don't think we would have football otherwise.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
Nerds. Today's episode is sponsored by NerdWallet's Smart Money Podcast. Ready to expand your financial game? NerdWallet can coach you on smart strategies like choosing investments, finding your next credit card, and setting a budget that works for you. Score major points towards your summer vacation by learning expert tips for choosing a high-yield savings account and how to build wealth by investing in index funds. Slide into summer with smarter decisions in 2024. Follow NerdWallet's Smart Money Podcast on your favorite podcast app. Future you will thank you.
We really need new phones.
T-Mobile will cover the cost of four amazing new iPhone 15s, and each line is only $25 a month.
New iPhone 15s? It's better
over here. Only at T-Mobile, get four iPhone 15s on us and four lines for $25 per line per month with eligible trade-in when you switch.
Minimum of four lines for $25 per line per month with auto pay discount using debit or bank account. $5 more per line without auto pay, plus taxes and fees. Phone fee at 24 monthly bill credits for well qualified customers. Contact us before canceling account to continue bill credits or credit stop and balance on required finance agreement due. $35 per line connection charge applies. See T-Mobile.com.